The strength of the team is each individual member. The strength of each member is the team, said Phil Jackson.
Welcome to Coach to Scale, how modern leaders build coaching cultures. I'm your host, Matt Benelli. Join me as we build a community of like-minded professionals who share the belief that effective coaching improves the performance of every team member. Our mission is to help leaders become better coaches. The Coach to Scale podcast is sponsored by Coachem, the world's first AI coaching execution platform that leverages evidence-based coaching to increase quota attainment. And with that, let's get started.
This next guest is a leader and the consummate team player. He's held leadership positions at Brandwatch and at Forrester. Currently, he's executive vice president and head of sales at Quid. Mike DeLoya, welcome to Coach to Scale.
Thanks, Matt. Appreciate you having me.
Appreciate you coming on. Mike, let's jump in. I'm really looking forward to this conversation. We've had a lot of sidebars over the years, and I really think the audience can benefit from the types, from the what you have to say, and really driven by the values that drive you. So, Mike, there's a lot of myths in the business, and I know you're a go against the grain type of guy. But what's a myth in this business? You know, something you hear all the time when it comes to coaching and leading sales teams that you believe is misguided or maybe even complete BS?
That's a good question. There's a lot of things that I look at. You mentioned against the grain. I consider myself a non-traditional sales leader in a way. I do believe that process is very important, but I believe there's a myth out there that the process constantly has to be consistent. I believe you can actually adapt processes based on the situation you're in. And you don't have to have the same process in an organization for every part of the business. You can have one process for enterprise sales, one for commercial sales. It's okay. And you can adapt those processes as things change out there in the market. But there is a big myth that there's a magic process, there's magic metrics, et cetera, that you always follow and hit those numbers. And it's just something I haven't subscribed to in a long time since my initial foray into sales, where, you know, I was told make 100 calls a day, 3 hours of talk time, and you'll hit your numbers. And it was all about getting to those metrics and never hitting those numbers. And it was just a false way of getting to the outcomes.
Yeah. Arthur Red Motley said many years ago, what was considered at the time the 13 greatest words in sales: know your products, know your customers, call them incessantly and ask them to buy. And I was like, okay, times have changed. Why do you think that myth persists? Why do you think that many people believe that there's this magic process and it's one size fits all?
I think it's because there's a lot of old school thinking out there. You know, technology has changed. You know, we're doing an online podcast right now, for example. You know, the way you have to reach a prospect could be through multiple factors, through LinkedIn, through YouTube videos. I've had SDRs send TikToks, for example. There's no magic, you know, prescription to it. Like, you can't just pick up the phone and hammer it anymore. If you're trying to get a hold of me, any SDRs out there that are trying to get a hold of me, you might not want to call me. But if you do, leave a voicemail. You know how many SDRs don't leave a voicemail? I'm going to listen to that voicemail, and then I'm probably going to have you talk to somebody else. But keep trying new things.
So there's a nugget there, because you're right. A lot of people don't leave voicemails anymore. And granted, a lot of people don't listen to voicemails anymore. A lot of people don't even set up their voicemails anymore. But the challenge is, like, you have to find a way to get to the person. Mm-hmm. So you might not call the person back, but when you listen to that voicemail, is it fair to say that perhaps you're listening, like, maybe this person says something that catches mm-hmm. your attention, or they say it in a certain way, or they just seem like the type of person that you at least owe a call back or to respond to an email and say, hey, you know what? Thanks a lot. I'm not the guy, but you should talk to this person, right? Like, you can learn a lot from the voicemail just by listening to a 10-second voicemail.
Yeah, right? You go from zero chance to somewhat of a chance, because I will listen to it. And if it's sincere and you're selling to me, to my pain, I might call you back, or I might have someone else on my team call you back if you've done your homework. And that's one of the things going back to those myths, those hammer the phone, hit those metrics. We live in a day and age, you can't do that anymore because you need to know the pain in who you're talking to each and an individual time. Every outreach, whether it's an email, whether it's LinkedIn, et cetera, a voicemail, no one should have ever received that message but me. That's the way people need to think out there. You know, do the research. And if you've gotten to my pain, I will give you a call back.
Hyper-personalization, mm-hmm. meaning nobody can get that email except
exactly.
you, right? So some homework, some knowledge mm-hmm. needs to go into it. Some thought needs to go into it. So Mike, we talked, the podcast is Coach to Scale. So, you know, we're trying to help managers and leaders become better coaches. But what I found over the years is that the word coaching means something different mm-hmm. to everybody, to different people. What is coaching? What does that word mean to you?
For me, coaching starts as soon as that person, even on the interview, I ask questions on the interview to coach people if they, try and teach them something on an interview, especially if they're an AE or a younger SDR, for example. But for me, coaching is helping someone move throughout their career, helping them continue to improve. If they do well, we're going to do well as an organization. So I need to make sure that while I'm coaching someone, they know what's in it for them beyond just hitting their numbers. But I'm looking to really help them throughout their career overall. You know, it really helps, the organization want to win for you as well. So coaching is a big thing that I really take a lot of stock in. You know, when someone joins Quid or any company I've ever been at, I have a call with them. And the first thing I ask them is, what do you want to do next? Where do you want to go next? Because it's my job to get you there. And if you ever leave, for example, if you ever leave Quid, heaven forbid, I'm going to wish you well, but I'm going to ask you one question. Did you learn anything? And that's important as we go through, being part of really the, mentoring the new salespeople out there and then helping the, the senior salespeople get to their goals as well. Everybody has goals and those goals change, as you move throughout your career.
Yeah. And we had a guest on the show not too long ago. We just recorded it last week. And she talked about like different levels of leadership mm-hmm. in terms of coaching, mentoring, and sponsoring. And I can honestly say the words you just described, like where do you want to be? Mm-hmm. I've seen you in action do that. And that is your reputation. That's the legacy that you're starting to leave. People want to work for you. But do you find when you ask somebody, hey, what do you want to do next? When they're kind of just starting at the company, they're like, oh man, I don't know. Like, are they searching for the words you want to hear? Or do they have an answer or are they stumped?
I try to disarm them and say, there's no wrong answer. You might not know it now, but let's think about that and let's figure that out together. So that way we can figure out what is next. Sometimes I've had people come in and say, listen, I just got here. I just want to be your top performer. Like, that's great. Let's get you there. Or I want to make this much a year. Great. Let's get you there. Or I want to be a leader, or I never want to be a leader. Okay. Well, let's figure things out for you. I think we owe it to the people that work for us. They're not just a number, a quota, for example. Everybody's human. We owe it to them to give back to them as they're giving to us, and they will perform for you.
Yeah. I've definitely observed too much of the opposite, which is, no one will say it, but they'll, all they talk about is the deal, the deal, the deal, yeah. the forecast. And, they'll utter tongue in cheek phrases like don't name the farm animals, they may not be around in a while. And it's just, obviously that has the opposite effect, on the culture that you're seeking to build. But when you talk about getting somebody to where they want to be, I think a couple things go into that. One is the skills development required for them to be mm-hmm. successful in their current role. Because if they're not successful in their current role, mm-hmm. all bets are off. But then also thinking about, how to create a path for them to get where they may want to go in the future. How do you think about that in terms of, let's say, the tactical deal type coaching, mm-hmm. right? You versus the career coach?
Well, they're two different things. You know, I'm pretty senior where I am now, but if an SDR is promoted to an account executive, and this is what I've done for years in different organizations, I have them set up a one-on-one with me and I become their mentor. And the biggest thing I want to achieve there is I don't want them to talk about deals in that meeting. That meeting is for coaching, where they'll bring something to me. They might bring gong calls. They might bring, you know, items they're having issues with, for example. Or they might bring, okay, I want to move into product marketing. What skills do I need to get there? And I will help them through that. But it's never about the deals. Those are a separate conversation. It's really good to compartmentalize those things. And we have those coaching conversations as what they are. I can coach on deals during that conversation, but this conversation's for you and your career.
And a lot of times, like I've heard managers say, what am I going to have a career conversation with my people like every week? That seems like overkill. And obviously the answer is no on that, but how often do you find yourself, is there a framework that you use or that you recommend in terms of how often should you have those aspirational conversations?
At least once a month, if that, to see how they're doing, how they're pacing against the goals, how they're feeling overall. You know, what have you learned over the past month? You know, I was once told, this is earlier in my career, if you couldn't update your resume every 6 months, it was time to move on.
Ooh, yeah. Okay. What does that mean?
That means you haven't learned anything, or you haven't been able to, you know, as a salesperson say, you know, I've closed this large deal, or, you know, these are things I've accomplished at this organization. So it's not about promotion. It's about, you know, achievements, for example. You know, that's the one thing I look at a resume, for example, if someone, I see everything, I see every place you work, but the only thing I really want to look at are your achievements. And I want those up top. If I don't see achievements up top, we're probably not going to have a conversation. So,
all right. I love where you're going with this. So achievements, is achievements to you anything other than, did 2 million on a $1 million quota, you know, 200, whatever, you know, 200%. Is that the achievement, or are there other types of achievements that you are impressed by and moved by when looking at it?
I'm always impressed by what you've just said, of course. So when, you know, hitting your quota, achieving your quota, making President's Club, being the top performer, top 10, whatever, that's always going to be first and foremost. But I'm always looking to see, what did you do outside your role? You know, what did you do to help the company with your company hat on? You know, I helped roll out our enterprise sales process, you know, or I worked with the SC team to create a new way to do solutions-based presentations. You know, I always tell people when they start, the two things I look for in success are, one, I want you to build your brand internally and externally. And building your brand internally means that you're using your voice. You're telling us what you think should be different, what we can do to improve. Plus, you're gaining trust out there and creating people that want you to win too. You're creating your win team. You know, we've talked about this, Matt. We're in enterprise sales here. I don't like it when reps go in it alone and say, oh, I closed this deal all by myself. I think they left money on the table. But the secondary piece I look for are people that are accountable. They're accountable for their own success, so the CEO of their own company. And, you know, they're not going to make excuses, but they're also the people that are going to try to do things to further the company, bring ideas to the company. Hey, we should take the company in this direction. I'm not on the ground anymore. I need to hear these things from reps, and then I go validate, and then I can take action. But those are the type of achievements I look for. What have you done to change process? What have you done to advance that company? Have you coached other teammates, things like that? Those stand out to me.
And okay, so what do you say to the person who underperformed, let's say, the quarter or the year, and they say, yeah, but Mike, I know, came up short, but I was spending a lot of time helping to roll out the enterprise sales process, or I was spending a lot of this time mentoring new hires, and I, you know, it just, you know, took my eye off the ball. Which one comes first?
Of course, hitting your numbers, but it's up to that person's leader to make sure they're not spending all their time working on that. The leader is the one that should be accountable there, not the rep, making sure they're doing the right things in order to get their business done.
No bad dogs, just bad owners. No bad kids, just bad parents. No bad reps, just bad sales leaders.
Sometimes,
right? firing for effect there, tongue in cheek. Exactly. But it's all about personal responsibility, exactly. Right? It's about taking responsibility for the team to which you're responsible.
Exactly.
Right? I think is the gist of what you're getting at. I love what you said about creating your win team, and specifically, you said if someone came into you and said, Mike, this deal just came in, $1 million. And you said, wow, that's fantastic. Who was on your win team? Who helped you? I did it myself. We've had this conversation. Your first thought there is, man, we left a lot of money on the table if you did this deal yourself. Can you elaborate on that a little bit? And maybe who's part of that win team?
Yeah, this happened a lot, over the years where reps do feel sometimes like they want to be the hero. I did all these demos by myself. I did the discovery, et cetera. I didn't need any help. I look at that deal and I think, again, like you said, I'm worried about, one, how much could this deal have been if we brought in the content experts? And I'll talk about who these people are in a second. But what I'm more concerned about are all the deals we lost. Because I have to think your win rate isn't that good. So now I'm going to start digging into that and start to understand the leads you're getting, understand the conversations you're having. And that's going to be a coaching conversation. And that even could lead into further conversations. But the win team typically depends on the deal. We have a very complex sale here at Quid. We sell to 9 different roles. We have multiple use cases. No two deal is the same. Two deals are the same. So if a new business rep is talking to, let's say, someone in, automotive manufacturing, and they're talking to that person within the CX team, I want them to be talking to AMs that work with people in CX, for example. What do they care about? What's resonating? What's changing out there in the environment? I want them working with their solution consultant to do deep discovery and have them lead that process through the demo. Working with strategists, people within CS, anybody it takes to win that deal. That could go all the way up to our CEO. You got to make sure every deal you walk into, you're situational selling. No two deals are the same in the enterprise.
And I think that's a learning experience for a lot of people, right? They come. I think a lot of sales professionals, especially ones early on in their careers, they think they're supposed to do it alone. They think they get higher marks. Mm-hmm. For doing it alone. So when you come at that contrarian against the grain type of view is, wait, what do you mean you did it yourself? Mm-hmm. I would imagine, I actually know that that's like hitting someone between the eyes, like pearls of wisdom fired in the form of bullets sometimes. Like somebody comes, calls you up and says, hey, I closed this deal, I did it alone. And all of a sudden they're getting off that call, like with their tail between their legs, realizing that, maybe they left money on the table and they didn't do the right thing. There's good and bad, right? In that, those are learning experiences. I guess the good news is you got the deal, and there's a lesson learned.
Exactly. But again, let's be fair. There are, this is my industry, what I do here. We're within the complex selling solutions that we do here within the enterprise. It's virtually impossible to win alone. But there are industries out there. There are, SaaS platforms out there that, yes, you can certainly do it. Reps can demo that themselves. They can have that conversation. It's more of a transactional sale. So I think it's really understanding, again, what type of sale can I go alone versus which ones do I need that win team? Again, no two deals are the same.
Yeah. In terms of being on the buying side, let's not name names. We're not trying to disparage any companies here. But I recall a story that you told when you were evaluating technology in a former company, and there was one technology that I think you thought was a little bit better in terms of the features that it had, but you were kind of leaning in the other direction because of the buying experience. Mm-hmm. Can you elaborate a little on that? Because again, there's way too many people selling features and benefits mm-hmm. that aren't thinking about the buying experience. And we all know those. We like anecdotally, like kind of know that in the back of our mind. But I remember you telling me this story and it was like real. Yeah.
Talk a little bit about that. I remember this one. Yeah. So I think it's important to know your buyer, know how that person needs to be sold to. Again, there's no selling to you might be much different than selling to me. Try to understand, you know, how that person needs to be communicated to and sold to. You know, I am one that if I'm getting constant emails, if I'm getting hit up on, I think at the time it was our instant messaging tool. I forget what we were using at the time. Like constantly coming at me is not going to get me to win that deal, but you have to know your buyer. And that goes beyond just selling to me, the budget holder. You know, I talk to my solution consulting team about this all the time and my sales reps. There's a time to get technical and there's a time to be high level and sell outcomes. You need to know if you're talking to a technical buyer or if you're talking to someone who just needs to know it works. So it's really not just about that part of the sales process in terms of what happened with me, but any part of the sales process, you need to really understand how does this person need to be talked to where they're really going to understand what we can do for them. We can't lift the hood of a car for someone that doesn't know anything about cars. They just need to know it's going to drive them down the street. Now, someone that's into cars wants that hood open. We can do that when it's time.
Yeah. Yeah. Are you selling to the folks in the balcony or are you selling to the folks on the dance mm-hmm. floor? You got to sell to both, but and that's good. But you just can't make the mistake of selling to the folks on the dance floor when you're actually talking to the C-suite
exactly.
and the buyers. So, Mike, what's a tough lesson learned in your career that you wish you knew just a little bit earlier?
This goes way back to like one of my first sales jobs. Now, again, I started my career very differently. I was a graphic designer at an ad agency. I kind of ended up in sales at the time. But in my initial selling, one of the harder conversations I had was with the CEO of the company. He brought me into his office and really laid into me about my pipeline. And I thought I had a really good pipeline, but it wasn't a really good pipeline. There's a lot of deals in there that have been there some time. And what he taught me that day in that tough conversation was, one, we think you have what it takes to be successful here. If you want to do it, we'll invest in you, or we could just part ways right now. So he gave me that choice. I chose, let's double down and do this. But at the same time, what he taught me that day is to learn how to punt. And that's one thing that I try to do with all younger salespeople right now is teach them when it's time to punt. Now, Matt, you and I have worked together for some time through leveraging the Sandler methodologies, et cetera. My favorite part of Sandler is the breakup letter. They close your file. And that's something I teach mm-hmm. constantly because it's going to get us to a yes or a no. And a no is just as good as a yes because it's saving us time to go to the next thing. But that was a big lesson, the one that shaped my career because it kept me in sales, having that tough conversation, but also called me out. And one of the things that I need to learn how to do better is move on because I'm wasting my time.
Move on. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Punch, you know, either close mm-hmm. it or, you know, close the file or close mm-hmm. the deal. You've talked a lot of it in the past about winning the second sale, mm-hmm. right? So your team typically does a larger, complex enterprise type deals. Can you explain what you mean by winning the second mm-hmm. sale and why it's a focus? Like, what are some of the mistakes people make along the way there?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's always timing. For example, forecasting has a lot to do with it. You know, enterprise deals can take, you know, depending on the organization, working in healthcare could be 9 months. You know, typical enterprise sale is going to be, you know, 4 to 6 months on average. Yeah. You're selling probably during that time to get that vendor a choice. That's probably 2 to 3 months. That second sale is when you're selling to procurement, you're selling to legal, you're working through all of the red lines, et cetera, and trying to make sure you're not making a mistake and negotiations with procurement, et cetera. But always working backwards, you know, typical sales 101, you know, having your sequence of events down, making sure you're understanding and reading if anything's changing in that organization, you know, because that can happen quickly as well. Making sure you're staying in touch with the business users in terms of where we're, this is what we're working towards. Do you need anything else here? Do you remember what your, you know, kickoff, et cetera, what you're purchasing? There was one deal I sold a few years ago with a colleague of mine. It took 10 months to close. We were in procurement for six of those months. By the time we closed it, the business users didn't remember what they bought. We had to totally resell it at the kickoff. So, but I think the second sale, you know, we have to remember how long that will take, especially when it comes to forecasting. That's the biggest mistake people make. Biggest mistake is not having that checklist, making sure they're constantly asking questions, making sure if I get on the phone with you this morning, Matt, and now I'm getting on the phone with you this afternoon, I need to ask, has anything changed since the last time we chatted? You're going to be like, Mike, we just chatted this morning. I just said to ask. Things change fast in this environment. But hey, he's asking the question.
I know it's only been a couple of hours. Is there anything I need to know? Has anything changed since we last spoke? Classic question to make sure you don't get blindsided down the road.
Do your research as well. That, you know, one time a rep came, that was, I was the buyer, came to me. I was ready to give them vendor a choice the day before. She came to me to talk about, you know, next steps, et cetera, and didn't really get into anything. I'm like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Like, we have to delay this. We got purchased today. Didn't you read the news? So always before every call, Google the company you're talking to see if something's going on there.
Yeah. Again, wise advice, but then also very something very tactical to do. So you read the news, you get it, and then like, what do you do with that information? You know, you talked about the, you know, we talked about winning the second sale. The way someone described it to me in the past was, it's like climbing a mountain. It's like climbing Mount Everest. Most of the deaths that happen on Mount Everest are on the way down. Most of the deals that die that are real, that were in the forecast, are basically like the equivalent of coming down the mountain, not going up the mountain. Going up the mountain, you get to the summit. That's like getting the technical win. And sometimes you get too ecstatic, like, yeah, we're the vendor of choice. And then you realize, well, wait, we got to get this damn thing over the goal line. And we don't want to die going down the mountain. So I always remember that analogy, as morbid as it is. Sorry. So you're over at Quid now. You're settled in, but still fairly new. You know, it doesn't feel that way. Can you tell the audience, what does Quid do, and what attracted you there?
It's a good question. So I've been in market research for some time now. I'm not going to date myself, but I've been doing it for a while. And I always felt what Quid does, you know, in taking unsolicited, you know, real-time consumer insights is that next evolution in market research. And you need real-time data, you need real-time insights. And Quid was one of the only organizations out there that I felt was dedicating the time and resources specifically to customer context. You know, not focusing on traditional social listening, but focused on that evolution of market research to get organizations information quick as it relates to their goals. What really attracted me here was their dedication to moving in that direction. And the shift that we were making towards really more of a solution-based enterprise sale. That's how I scale companies. I scale companies that maybe in the past were commercial-focused into an enterprise-focused organization. So it gave me the ability to really transform the organization, working closely with our marketing team, et cetera. And the people here are just great. You know, they listen. They are collaborative. They'll challenge you when you should be challenged. But, you know, it gave me the opportunity to really kind of create something of my own. And I really do believe in what we're doing out there with customer context, leveraging, obviously, generative AI. We've been doing it for 10 years. You know, we're kind of at the forefront of this. And again, that evolution of market research, when I started, when it was mail-based surveys, and now here we are. You know, this is something organizations need to really understand their customer and who they want to be their customer.
So, Mike, you brought up generative AI. AI in general is a lot, you know, a lot of talk these days, a lot of press, a lot of promise. Some people think it's hype. You know, we're not 100% sure yet. But there's also a lot of fear amongst salespeople, as well as other professions, that, hey, we're going to get replaced. Is AI technology something that salespeople should be afraid of, or should they embrace it? And if embrace it, how so? What's an example?
There's always going to be a human element to sales. People buy from people. You know, we all know that. So I don't think they should fear it. I think they should embrace it. And we're embracing it here, for example. You know, generative AI can be used in many different things. You write an email, for example, you know, good outbound email, it can help you edit that, make it even better, right? A lot of companies out there now have generative AI where you could install the email. It's going to tell you everything that's wrong with it and what the potential open rates could be. So it's all about improving, right? Elaborate on this email or reduce it, et cetera. Or tell me, for example, I'm selling to a data scientist, rewrite this as if how a data scientist would like to see it, like that would resonate to them. Or for researching organizations, using Bard, for example, to understand more about the company that you're selling to and how they're set up. So I would say generative AI should be in really the process of any salesperson, any SDR, any solution consultant, you know, any strategist out there that's customer facing. Use it to improve your message. You know, there's no reason to fear it.
Are we at the point where you or your leaders are asking questions to potential sales candidates? Like, tell me about a time where you've leveraged AI technology in a sales cycle or in your prospecting efforts. I mean, are you trying to figure out who is evolving or who is still, behind the times?
That is a question we'll ask, but sometimes we can tell too. You know, if someone's giving a 30, 60, 90 presentation for us, I can tell if that was just developed right from AI or that they've done that themselves and tried to adapt it to the business that they're trying to work at. So we can tell when they're doing it and when they're not, but I do ask questions around how they would adapt and use it in their sales process. I think it's important. Yeah. You know, everything changes out there. We have to adapt to change, just like what Quid is doing in terms of traditional market research to where we are now. You know, organizations need to adapt to change, or they're going to fall behind, just like a salesperson will if they're not using it.
If you're not growing, you're dying. What is it? Charles Darwin said, it's not the strongest species that survive. It's the ones that are most adaptable to change. Mm-hmm. And there's been a lot of change in our business, enterprise technology and B2B SaaS over the years, and many more changes promised for the mm-hmm. future. But to be clear on what you said, someone who uses AI, you know, generative AI to help them with an interview with a 30, 60, 90, that's okay. You're talking about like, did they do the homework for you, or did you use it to help you formulate your opinion? Like, there's a difference.
Big
there,
difference.
Right?
Did you write it and have them elaborate, or did you just say to give me a 30, 60, 90?
Write this for
me. Exactly. Exactly.
Hey, take this test for me. So speaking of tests, not tests, but, you know, books, just out of curiosity, anything that, you know, that you would recommend or you like, or, you know, something that you're reading these days or recently that, that's worth highlighting out here?
The most recent book that I read was when I was, again, my last two companies, I'd been there 10 in 6 years. So I'm not out there much, especially when I have to drive change. So the most recent book I read was called The First 90 Days, coming into an organization and really starting to understand, you know, what I should take on first. You know, you can't take everything on at once, and really understand kind of where the changes should happen. So I think that for anyone moving into a new organization as a sales leader, The First 90 Days is a really good book to read.
Awesome. I will check that out, and we'll put that in the show notes too. We had a guest on recently, Mike, Christina. She spent almost 20 years at Salesforce, and she is over at MongoDB now. And she talked about those first 90 days in a really cool way. And she said, you know, there are glass balls and there are rubber balls. And the glass balls, those are the really important things that as someone who's onboarding, you can't drop. You really have to make sure that you protect that, that you master that, that you learn that in those first 90 days. And then there's the rubber balls, which are, hey, it would be great if you can kind of figure out this too. So, you know, I'm just trying to connect the dots for people listening out there that, you know, talking about the importance of those first 90 days, regardless of what your role is in the company and how you can help people be successful and ramp up faster, because ramp time, the quicker the ramp time, the more the company starts to achieve the ROI and the more the individual starts to achieve the ROI. So Mike, coach, Super Bowl occurred very recently here. So, you know, there you see the coaches there, there's football coaches. Forget about, it doesn't have to be football or athletics. You can go anywhere in general. When you, if I ask you who your favorite coach is, what would you say?
Well, I'm always going to say Bill Belichick, but I'm not going to say it now. But unfortunately, the Patriots were not in the Super Bowl, and they won't be for some time.
We're going to get Marvin Harrison Jr. I'm going to find someone to throw.
I'm hoping J.J. McCarthy throwing to Marvin Harrison Jr., but that's just me. But we'll see what happens. But you know, there's a lot of great coaches out there, but sometimes you know, I don't know if anyone's used this on your podcast before, but gave it a thought since you brought it up to me earlier, and we'll go with someone who's not a real coach. You know, we'll go with a television coach, Ted Lasso. You know, I don't know if anyone's used that one before, but his techniques were, he was coaching you, but letting you come to your own conclusions in a way, you know, giving you the tools to kind of come to the realization you're on your own, you know, and I think that's big as someone who's learning, et cetera, that you can come to that answer yourself, but your coach, your mentor is guiding you to give you the questions you should be thinking in your head. That's a big thing. I just binge watched that series with my wife, and I am not a soccer fan, but I love that. I did love that show. So
somebody sent me a clip fairly recently, because I think I watched the first episode. It didn't hit me right off the bat, but the clips that I've seen since then, they all resonated. So, I might dig in. Do you recall seeing the darts episode when he's throwing the darts? That was my favorite.
Because he grew up in a pub. It was great. Not to give it away, but it was good.
So, YouTube Ted Lasso darts scene. Everybody, if you're curious on that. Mike, you know, usually right at the end here, I ask a question about somebody who has impacted your career. And what I mean by that is people who are interested and driven by coaching and developing others usually had that behavior modeled for them at some point. Can you talk about a time where somebody's impacted your career?
Absolutely. I mean, I've had a lot of great coaches. You know, I've had a lot of great, you know, CROs, VPs, SVPs, managers, like people I've reported to directly. But probably the one biggest piece of advice I ever got was from a peer. So, and it was my first day of my first day of Forrester Research starting out. I joined a team that was struggling a bit. You know, we were the data analytics sales team. And I sat down and I asked my peer a question, like, why are we having so much trouble? What makes you successful? And she told me, Mike, own it. Do it your own way. Run it like your own business and you'll be successful. And no one had ever told me that until that time. This was years ago. And to this day, that one piece of advice, if I didn't get it, I wouldn't be sitting here right now. So that was the best piece of advice I got. And it's a very general piece of advice, but sometimes you just need to be told directly that it's okay to own it and do it your way. So I did. And here we are.
Did you ever tell her the impact that had on you?
I have told her that many of times. So, but yeah, that's, and I tell that story quite a bit. So
that's great. It's a great story. Own it. You know, people could say, well, okay, I get it, but what does that mean? So is there a modern example of where if there's a sales rep who's trying to do his or her best to succeed, and someone next to him says, you know what? You're new here. You're hungry. You got to own it. Mm-hmm. What's an example of
it's owning? Taking things from your experience and doing it in a way that's going to make you successful. People, you can have your own voice. You can have your own message, your own technique, as long as we're all, you know, trying to get to the same endpoint with the same overall arching messaging of the organization. But everyone has to have their own style. And I think it's making sure people are comfortable leveraging their own style and pushing back where they need to push back. You know, if a rep is confident that they can win this business if they go this way, tell me. I'm not always right. Your sales leader's not always right. We're, again, remember, we're team selling here. So we need to listen to our reps, because sometimes they might have it. They might have that information that we don't, what it's going to take to win that deal. Or if they can do it in their own style, we have a better chance to win that deal. So we're not all robots out there. We can do things in our own way.
Yeah. Strategy is non-negotiable, but style exactly. is. Own your style. Well, I think that's an awesome place to leave it, Mike. Own it. Mm-hmm. Like, we'll leave it with that. I really enjoyed this conversation. Thanks a ton for investing your time with us.
No, today. I appreciate it. And thanks for having me on.
All right. And for everybody out there watching and listening, thank you for doing that. Wherever you're consuming your podcast, whether it be YouTube or Spotify, or consuming it, reading it on LinkedIn, hit the like button if you like it. Let us know what you like. Let us know what you don't like. And let us know what you'd like to see more of. We want to deliver content and guests who are informative, who provide actionable tips like Mike did today, and who are also interesting. So hopefully we're doing that for you consistently. I feel like we definitely did that today. Thanks to you, Mike. And until next time, coach them if you want to keep them.
We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Coach to Scale, How Modern Leaders Build Coaching Cultures. For show notes and other episodes, visit us at coachem.io. That's coachem.io. And follow us on Twitter at coachemnow. See you all next week. Thanks for joining. And remember, coach them if you want to keep them.